Coming up today, we try on Nike self-lacing trainers, learn about the most common phobias, and play with a new product from Kodak. You're listening to episode 290 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, Matt Burgess, and joining us today is Victoria Wollaston.
Hello.
Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
And Ruby Lott-Lavinia for the first time.
Hello, hello, hello.
So, Ruby, every week on the podcast, we do something that you've learned this week. You're going to kick us off. What have you learned?
Okay, so I'm a bit disappointed in this. I think it's actually quite boring, but I'm going to go in with it anyway. So yesterday at the security conference that we'll talk about a little later, the issue of why aeroplanes have circular windows came up. And the reason is for structural integrity, so we don't all die, which is interesting because apparently they had loads of crashes and they found out that it was because the windows were square.
That's not boring at all. That's really, really interesting.
Anything to do with death.
But yeah. Just something that I'd never even thought about.
But what have you thought about and learned this week, Vicky?
Well, what I have learned this week is actually talking about wire security again. During Cameron Colquhoun's talk, I actually learned about stock doxing. So I knew what doxing was generally. It's when someone finds and publishes private information about you or about someone, puts it online, and it's usually with malicious intent. So what stock doxing is, takes it to another level. So it's where companies or, I mean, even individuals can do it. They file often fake or embellished reports that criticise other companies deliberately to damage their reputation. An example that Cameron gave was a report from a previously unknown research body called Zatara criticised finance firm Wirecard. So that report was then shared by the FT, and within a day, 25% had been wiped off the share price of the e-commerce company.
So deliberately damaging their stock so they can buy stocks and then get, or not they, but somebody can buy stocks and increase the price of their
exactly.
own worth. That's pretty sophisticated as a way of like attacking companies. And the thing that I've learned this week is not sophisticated at all. I think it's something that's probably actually quite commonly known, but I didn't know. Cows, the positioning of their eyes means they almost have a 360 degree vision because they're right on the sides of their heads. They can see like right down to sort of, it's just their body that's in their way of their view.
That's amazing.
Yeah, who knew?
So theoretically they can see behind them.
Pretty much, or quite a long way. I mean, I haven't actually spoke to a cow to determine this, but...
That is an issue.
Amelia, what have you learned this week?
So I learned about the cost of E.T.'s phone call home. So I found this one really amusing because I do love E.T. the film. So a telecommunications firm called Toll Free Forwarding, they like to provide toll-free international phone numbers. They decided to commission a study to determine how much E.T.'s phone call actually cost. So does anyone want to have a guess?
Well, the problem that I have with this, apart from the fact that E.T. is not real, if we take that away, how do they even know where E.T. was living? Where was his home?
The study didn't go into too much detail.
Oh, God, knowing how much it cost to phone America, I'd probably say £1 million.
I'm going to be a killjoy. He didn't phone home, so nothing. It didn't cost him anything.
Well, according to the study, it cost $26 quadrillion, which is about 71 times the US's national debt. So I thought that was quite interesting.
Poor Elliot's family.
I know, think of that on your phone bill.
You need so much paper just to be able to actually get that through the door. We've already mentioned it a couple of times already, but Wired Security, our first ever security conference, took place yesterday in London. We gathered 17 speakers for our main stage, from people involving individual security researchers, people from really big companies and who have really fascinating stories to tell about security, online privacy, hacking, spooks, people who are involved in the national intelligence regime as well. And we also had a startup stage with 14 companies pitching their ideas. And it's the latest string to Wired's bow of about 6 conferences now that we run. And it's really fascinating day with lots of really good top end speakers that were really insightful about the latest threats that are going on and how people are being hacked and really the dangers that exist online. So I have a quick question for all three of you. Who were your favourite speakers? Or just one each. Who was your favourite speaker and what were they talking about?
I'll go first. My favourite was Marty Crystal, who is from Israel. So he flew all the way over for the conference. He is a professional negotiator. So CEOs ask him to negotiate with hackers when their data is being held ransom. His talk was really interesting. he really like made it very funny and very accessible for something that could be quite a difficult topic. So he took the audience through a hostage situation from the first email from a hacker to someone in a company saying, we've got your information, we want 500 bitcoins, I think it was, which was about $120,000 at the time, US dollars. So from that email, he showed us the WhatsApp messages between him and the hackers, complete with emoji and little bits of Russian in order to engage and flatter the hackers that he was working with. So he said it was the human factor, engaging with the hackers, finding out the problem and driving down the price of the ransom overall. So he could ultimately improve the company's cybersecurity so it doesn't happen again. But what he was saying was that hacking is something that can affect all of us. It's not just big financial corporations, which was the company in this example. And I think just the way that he did it, you can watch his video online and it was really funny and just really engaging and a really accessible way of understanding it all.
It's fascinating stuff how negotiating about ransoms that are being hacked and held by hackers and things everywhere else. Vicky, what did you really like from the stage?
My favourite one is actually the reason I liked the conference so much yesterday is so many of these experts came in and they gave some really proper anecdotes. So what you were saying, Matt, about how it makes it accessible and it's describing things in a way that people may not understand. My favourite one was actually BAE Systems' Adrian Nish. So Adrian Nish is head of threat intelligence in its applied intelligence division. Similar to what Motti did, he took us through a recent banking heist and how actually he compared it to Ocean's 11. So he was sort of saying in Ocean's 11, George Clooney will get the gang together and they'll do the setup and they'll do preparation. Then they flip the switch on the vault and then they take away the money. And he was saying this is almost identical to that, but it's all done digitally. It's all done virtually. So, I mean, in February this year, hackers broke into the Bangladesh bank and they stole $951 million from the Central Reserve. It took 6 months to plan, 4 days to execute. But what I thought was the most interesting is the hackers deliberately tried to cover up their tracks. But the intelligence officers and intelligence researchers managed to find clues about who they were by ultimately linking it to the Sony Pictures hack from 2014, is it? So the fact that these two groups could... Are these sophisticated hackers who are trying to hide their steps actually got found out by the link between them? That was what I thought was really interesting.
It is just fascinating how they actually do this and then just you can really track back and find out what hackers were up to and stuff. But Ruby, what took your attention?
So my favourite talk involved two of my favourite things, Kim Kardashian and pizza. And it was a guy called...
Both fantastic things.
Exactly. So it was a guy called Jamie Woodruff, who essentially described himself as an ethical hacker, which kind of means that he's hired by companies to carry out a penetration test, which is basically to see how easy it is to kind of enter a building and access their servers. So he told a great anecdote about how he'd been hired by a company to do this. So he sat kind of outside their headquarters for a while and observed what was happening for months. And what he noticed was that every Friday pizza was delivered and this pizza guy was let in through security without any checks and it was really easy for him to access. So what Woodruff did was he got a job at the pizza company.
This is dedication.
Yeah, the same pizza company. I think he was employed for like 2 days, so just, you know, just going and delivering pizza. Then he turned up to this company that he was trying to access. He got put through straight into the building without any security checks. He then went to the room with the servers. He accessed the server room because they had a very old, like kind of 1980s lock where you like push in the code and turn a knob thing. And he said he could just like spray some UV spray and check which buttons had been pressed and access the servers easily, which is hilarious and kind of journalism-y and also, you know, just amazing like on the ground hacking that happens. Obviously it was all legal and allowed by the company, but he did say that the head of security at the company was then fired afterwards, which brought up some questions of how ethically this kind of hacking is. And he also told the story about how he noticed a security risk on Kim Kardashian's website with the, I think it was the WordPress plugins, and he kind of highlighted this to her. Didn't hear anything back and then noticed a change a week later on the website and asked whether, you know, this had upset him. He was like, well, don't like Kanye anyway, so I don't care. Which, you know, I completely disagree because Kanye is amazing. But yeah, he was a great talk.
Yeah, he really was. And my particular favourite was Czech recipient from the startup stage. They were actually the winners of the startup stage, so they had the best pitch, and they were picked by our judges to be the top startup. And they're basically developing a system of machine learning that scans emails and will tell you if you're going to send an email to the wrong person. So if you're going to accidentally send out personal company details, which could easily be hacked or leaked online or get you a big fine from somewhere, they actually this system pops up a warning, says, do you actually mean to send this to this person? Everybody who was there on the day was really fantastic and really good speakers, and everybody that we've covered and spoke about has all got a write-up online, so you can go watch their talks online, learn out how not to get hacked, learn how to protect your accounts, see what the government's doing in terms of it's trying to stop hackers, and watch everybody's videos and see their reader write up of their talks as well. So really worth checking out, and definitely something that you should do if you get the time. Vicky, this yes. is something slightly different.
This is a bit of a curveball for the Wired UK podcast, and it's a lot easier to manage than security. This story is really close to my heart. It means a lot to me. I've spoken of my love of Drake on the podcast, and I only love one other man more than Drake.
That's me, obviously.
Well, okay, outside of the office, I only love one man more than Drake, and it's Alan Partridge.
Who is Alan Partridge for our international listeners? Because okay. they may not know.
So, I mean, if you haven't ever watched an episode of Alan Partridge, and Ruby and I were talking about this morning that she's never seen an episode of Alan Partridge.
I'd just like to say that I do have a large amount of comedy knowledge, but Partridge is not part of that, unfortunately.
And my team will attest to the fact that Partridge is my idol and role model, and I base a lot of my decisions and how I talk based on Alan Partridge. So Alan Partridge is a character invented by Steve Coogan. He's a local radio DJ who is the most cringeworthy man ever. He's really awkward with women. He's just really awkward socially. And it's about him. It started off with Knowing Me, Knowing You, and it was a TV show that he had. Then he got canned by the BBC. So then the follow-up series is about him trying to get back on the BBC and just being really bitter about it. Sounds negative. It's really not. So he released a book. Alan released a book. Steve Coogan released a book a couple of years ago called I, Partridge, We Need to Talk About Alan. And now the follow-up to this book called Nomad came out. It's out on sale this week. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to read you two extracts just to get across the comedy legend that is Partridge. And I apologise if you don't find this funny. I find it hilarious.
Well, let's see what he's got to say in this role then. Because, for those who are listening from overseas, Alan Partridge is quite a really culture icon in the UK. And the TV show was first on in about the 70s or 80s, I think it was.
So it's a bit later than that.
Yep. But yeah, here we go. Let's see what he's got to say now.
So this is Alan Partridge. I'm going to have to get through this without laughing. This is Alan Partridge talking about another cultural icon in the UK, Noel Edmonds. So Partridge says, "So familiar is his face that people rarely stop to look at the guy, meaning his preposterous appearance is given a free pass. Well, not today, because I invite you to inspect him with me now. The flaxen locks that defy both gravity and fashion sense are dyed that colour, a secret style choice he might get away with if it were not for his dark beard. I once found a notebook belonging to Edmonds in which he sketched potential new hairstyles, each bigger and fluffier than the last. Next to them, he'd calculated the amount of hairspray required to scaffold the hair and keep it from dropping. Well, I thought this was priceless, but he insisted there was nothing stupid about the lift-to-weight equation he used and claimed it was first used in the 16th century by art whiz Leonardo da Vinci."
Serious mathematics there to make sure that you have that hair height.
I mean, you're just learning all the time with this book. I'm going to read one more and then I'll get off this subject. So Alan Partridge is from Norfolk in the UK. This is how he describes his hometown. "Norfolk has it all. Its pastoral life a world away from the colourlessness of its county neighbour. When sneery city people apply the word culture to Norfolk, they usually prefix it with agri, haughty, or it doesn't have any. But if they bothered to open their eyes for a second, they'd see how thick they'd just been. We're not just a proud, hard-working people famed for our rich history and political might. We're a liberal bunch with an artistic bent, or better still, artistic leaning. Yep, Norfolk is a cultural hotbed."
Well, where do we go from there? So this book's out now?
Yes, this book is out. It's available from Amazon. It's currently available in hardback. What I did with the original book is Steve Coogan actually read an audiobook version, and I used to listen to that, when I was running. The problem was that I was laughing so hard that it used to throw my breathing all out of whack, but I'm hoping that this comes out in audiobook as well.
And just to reiterate, how much this is just your last chance to say how good Alan is. How much of a cultural icon is he? And why is he important, really?
I think he, without trying to dissect it too much and sort of add too much, it's just funny. It's hilarious. I think when it came out, it sort of captured this real, there was a lot of local DJs like Tony Blackburn and the likes of that that were almost parodies of themselves, and I think Partridge just took that on. But it's just something that people can relate to. I mean, most people have worked with someone who's a little bit awkward, a little bit weird. Why are you all looking at me like that? So I just think, and he just, and Steve Coogan has done a couple of characters since, and I saw him live when he did Alan Partridge and other characters, and it's amazing how the other characters are okay, but when he actually comes on Alan Partridge, I mean, that's the winner. But I highly recommend you watch at least one episode to get what I'm doing.
Isn't there a clip of Alan Partridge dancing with Kate Bush? I've definitely seen that, and that's great.
Yes.
That definitely wouldn't surprise me. Now, I've got a question for anybody who wants to answer. When I say the name Kodak, what do you think of?
That terrible song.
What song?
That rhymes Kodak with Kodak by Pitbull.
Okay, I was going to say cameras.
That was the answer that I was looking for. So Kodak, the camera company, manufacturer, and who has more recently moved into printing photographs and stuff as well. So delivery of photographs, quite a well-known brand in the UK and abroad as well. I think it was formed 128 years ago in the US, has released its first mobile phone this week.
So like a proper camera phone?
Yeah, that is basically what it is. It has released this new phone, which is called the Ektra. And it's actually, the name is taken and the style of the phone is actually taken from one of its cameras called the Ektra from 1941. So it's that sort of classic, the old camera is that sort of classic style, aluminium polished metal with a black casing on the front, which is sort of a leathery feel, really. And that's basically what the back of this phone looks like. It has got this same material on, it's repeating the same name, and they're trying to bring in some of the same features as well, but it is a phone and an Android device. And it's something that's quite different for the company.
So, I mean, obviously this is about the camera. So the problem I have with this is, like, how good's the phone part? Like, why would you buy this when you could buy either a camera or a decent phone? Like, I mean, you got to play with it, Matt, didn't you? What did you think of it?
So I got to play with it for about 10 minutes as they were announcing this phone and it's coming to market. And they were saying that the whole phone itself is designed for photographers, and that will interest hundreds of thousands of people in the UK rather than millions. So it's not really a mass market phone in their view. But we'll come on to that a bit later. But the phone itself, it's got a 21 megapixel Sony sensored camera on the back, and the selfie camera is 13 megapixels, which is quite high quality for a camera of that. It does 4K video, etc. And there's quite a few developments in the software as well, so they've actually tried to focus on not just the hardware of the camera, which involves some of the same sorts of features as actual Kodak cameras, but it's also the software is repeating what you can sort of see on cameras as well. So those people with DSLRs and SLR cameras, you'll be familiar with a little round knob and dial on the top of the camera, which lets you change settings. So they've actually put that onto a camera in a digital format. So it comes up on the screen and you can rotate round if you want manual, automatic, sport mode, etc. And it is quite nice as a feature, and some of the camera stuff does work very well, and all the photos that they've taken with it and were showing off, so obviously the better quality ones, all looked really good as photographs. And I think that's what they're really trying to focus on, trying to build into this, I guess, hipster market. There's some really nice leather cases that actually like an old camera case and look just a bit like you would have back in the 1940s for your camera to go in. So that's really what this phone is about. It's about its camera.
I mean, I think this is quite an interesting move because there's been quite a few companies who have partnered with camera makers. So Huawei did with the P9, the Nokia 1020. I mean, that had like a 41 megapixel sensor or not something. So it just it's certainly the way it's going. But I almost feel like when you've got a phone like the Pixel or like a HTC, where the actual phone itself is the selling product, and the phone itself is what is got all the really great features in terms of software and other things like that, it almost feels like Kodak's missing something.
Potentially, yeah. So when I was actually speaking to Jeremy White, Wired's gear editor, on about this phone, he was saying that the camera is one of the last big battlegrounds, or the most current battlegrounds, for phone manufacturers. And as you've mentioned there, lots of other companies are really focusing on this. And at the end of the day, people use their phones on the cameras quite a bit, but not a huge amount, I don't think. You are going to still be using this as a phone. That's what it's designed about. And in terms of its specs, they're quite good. It's got a 5-inch screen, a 32-gigabyte internal memory, 3 gigabytes of RAM. It's got the 3.5mm headphone jack. Take that, Apple. and yeah, 4K video capture. So basically all the things that other modern phones have, but it's sort of built into the whole device, which in my hand, it was quite thick. It was about a centimeter thick, which is quite thick for modern phones when you compare to look at the iPhone, the new Google Pixel phones. So it was still lighter than I thought, but just as like to look at from the outside, it wasn't something that I would buy directly. But then I'm not a photographer, mm-hmm. or somebody who might want to take really high quality photos when I'm out with my camera.
So we have talked a lot about smartphones recently. I feel like so many have been coming out, particularly Google, new Apple products and things. Do you think that this is a good contender against them? Do you think it could hold up against some of the more established smartphone brands on the market?
So to tout I guess Kodak's line for a minute, they've said that they've designed this for photographers, for people who are really into taking photos. And one of their representatives, and actually as a representative from the company that was licensed to build this phone, because Kodak didn't manufacture the phone, they put it out to a licensee, and then it was built abroad in Asia, I think it was in China. And also he was saying that this is not a mass market play. They don't want to be an iPhone beta. They don't want to be a Google Pixel beta or Samsung beta, but they just see that they have a specific audience that will be interested in this, and they don't think it's going to go mass market, but there's going to be enough people for them, or they hope, that will actually buy into it. And I think with the troubles that Samsung has with its most recent phones catching fire recently, there is a space in the Android market for people. You see HTC, other companies doing really nice phones that are coming out. And so I think people would definitely consider this. And the brand itself, when I think of Kodak, it's quite a nice brand to think of. It seems to be, to me, one that's got a bit of history in it and actually is something that you would trust with a product. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you feel that, Vicky. I know you haven't seen the phone, but in terms of like, if you were a big photographer, would you go for one phone that is really onto that, and that's its...
Yeah, I think I probably would. I think what you're right is Kodak is this really established camera brand, but even now, Kodak isn't necessarily one of the... It's certainly not one of the ones where I think, oh, that's a really high-end brand that you want to buy a normal camera from, like a DSLR. So maybe, I mean, I like how honest they're being. I like how they're going, look, we're not going to go after the big hitters. We're just, if you are interested in photos, but you don't have the money to spend it on DSLR, come and get off. And I do respect that.
Yeah, it was quite a nice approach for them to take. And the phone is actually coming out in December. It costs £449. Hopefully we'll get our hands on it a bit more to test the camera out properly and see what it really can do. So watch this space on that one, I guess. Coming up next, we're actually going to be talking about and finding out the most common phobias and what actually is a phobia. And also, Ruby has been trying on one of the most highly anticipated pair of trainers that people have been waiting for the last 20 years.
This year, Wired launched the Wired Audi Innovation Awards to celebrate the people achieving extraordinary things, from AI to design and science to social innovation. The nominees have been decided, and the awards will be handed out at a ceremony on November 9th. To find out more, visit wired.co.uk, search for the hashtag Wired Audi Awards, and pick up the January issue of the magazine, where we'll be showcasing the work of the winners.
Now, Ruby, a few days ago you went and tried out something that a lot of people want to try. I think there's only 86 of them in the world.
89.
So what was it that you went and tried out?
So I went... Back to the Future, and I went and tried some Nike Mags, which are the shoes that Michael J. Fox wears in the second film. They're kind of high tops, and they're also they've got the self-lacing laces, so they're very exciting. They've been talking about it for a while now, and the company have actually got sort of regular trainers with the same technology that I think they were working on for a decade. But these HyperAdapts are... they're called HyperAdapts, but these are ones based on the film. And so trying them on was quite cool. I sort of turned up to this room in the next door in Oxford Circus, and there was lots of UV lights, and it was very futuristic, and it was sort of in this glass box in the middle with light shining on it. And everyone was like, wow, wow, look at this. And I was like, yeah, cool, can I try them on now? And so what happens is you kind of whack your foot in, and the pressure on the sole triggers the laces that kind of tighten with your foot. And if you want to adapt it and make it tighter, you can press some buttons. It also has lights, which is cool, and to match the design.
And did they work? I guess that's the big question here. When you put your foot in, when you put that pressure down, did they tighten round your feet?
Yes, but there were a few occasions where I sort of had to kind of lean a bit on my leg to get them to kind of
like
kick
up
off.
And down.
Yeah. You know, I imagine if you were in a chase sequence and you really had to get your shoes on quickly, that could be an issue with
the
timing.
Oh, then I can't buy them.
Right, yeah. No, I just wanted to point this
constant
out to you, Vicky.
Chase sequences. So,
but generally, I'd say, I don't know, 4 of the 5 times I used it, it worked.
How did they actually feel on? Were they like heavy? Were they, you know, kind of like that with the technology? Does that make them heavier, like with the sole and things?
I mean, like it's kind of simple technology at the end of the day. Like it's nothing like, it's not like you're adding a computer to like a shoe. It's just, and they're high tops, which are pretty clunky anyway. But you can see that with the Hyperloops, the kind of normal trainers that Nike has, they're able to kind of fit
Hyperadapts.
They're able to fit the technology in like a much smaller trainer. So no, it wasn't too kind of cumbersome at all. Actually, it was. I probably wouldn't wear them around, but they were pretty usable.
Okay, so chase sequence aside, I really want these. How can I get them?
Okay, it's actually pretty hard.
Oh,
sorry. So all the profit goes to the Michael J. Fox Foundation, which is a Parkinson's charity. And they recently held a raffle with, I think it was like £10 or $10. And they raised $6.7 million for the foundation. But that's closed now, which is loads.
$6.7 million?
Yep.
That's incredible.
So there's one other option. Which is if you're lucky enough to be invited to a Michael J. Fox Foundation benefit, which they had one in China, they had one in London recently. They've been auctioning off the pairs, but you also are probably going to have to drop around $100,000.
I just keep getting barriers to getting these shoes.
Would you buy them, Ruby? If they brought the price down and mass manufactured these, would they be something that you'd buy or recommend to people?
So I'm like not that excited by them. I'm much more excited by the Hyperadapts because I think they're much kind of more commercially viable. Other than for nostalgia, I don't think they're really something that you go out and buy.
Well, that's a shame.
That is a shame. Although, Ruby, is it because you're a lot younger, so you weren't swept up in the whole Back to the Future?
I mean, I'm quite into those films, and I suppose, yeah, but, you know, at the end of the day, you can't be wearing kind of novelty trainers every single day of your life. And have that kind of
Do you know who would? Alan Partridge would.
He may well do. Ruby, thank you very much for going and trying on. It sounds like they were really interesting to go and just have a check out and do that. And there's a video actually on wired.co.uk of you trying them on. And actually you can see them self-lacing up. And they seem to work quite quickly. So
me sticking my foot in a shoe. It's very riveting.
It's worth watching.
It is worth watching. I enjoyed it.
So Amelia, what have you been looking at this week?
Recently, you may have been reading a lot in the news about this new killer clown craze, which is really difficult to say fast. I can just point that out. This is pretty much as terrifying as it sounds. People have been dressing up as clowns all across the UK and in the US to scare people in the streets. And since then, a lot of people have been saying, oh, this really terrifies me. I have a phobia of clowns, which obviously makes it a lot more scary. I mean, how do you guys feel about clowns? Phobias?
Do you know what? I don't have a problem with clowns. I mean, Stephen King's It is terrifying, but I don't remember ever growing up and being terrified of them. I do have a phobia. And the thing is, a couple of years ago, if someone said to me, oh, you have a phobia or something, I would have gone, well, what is a phobia? Oh, it's not even that big a deal. You're not even that scared. I really, really, really don't like holes, like tiny little holes in things. So I think the official term is like tryptophobia or something like that. And it's amazing how if I see a picture of them on the screen, it makes me feel physically sick. So all that time I was bashing phobias before, I completely go back on that. Like, it's terrifying. And there was a time when I was editing a story about tryptophobia. I had to edit all the words, but I had to give the piece to someone else to edit the pictures because I literally couldn't look at them.
So a proper phobia is actually a subtype of anxiety disorder. So I spoke to two psychologists about this to find out a bit more about phobias. And it is that absolute fear that you get, you know, you can feel your heart racing, you feel yourself getting hot and really panicky. And that is, you know, a real phobia. It is a real proper anxiety. So it's that when you're feeling dizzy, it makes you really scared of something. The phobia that comes into it with that is it makes you want to avoid something, and it's kind of that disproportionate effect on your life of wanting to avoid something you're super scared of.
Like an evolutionary thing, I guess.
Yeah, and this is the thing, like a lot of it comes from evolution. So phobias, like a single phobia, such as fear of holes, fear of clowns, spiders and snakes are obviously like two really big ones. They often start when you're younger because, you know, when you're little, if you were bitten by a poisonous spider, you would probably die. Whereas when you're older, you wouldn't, because obviously you're a lot heavier. You can kind of handle the poison a lot more. So that evolutionary, I'm going to stay away from this thing because this is really dangerous for me, is one of them. But then also like the fear of clowns, this is kind of a different one because it's like we are actually kind of taught that to be fearful of things that are like big and loud and weird and a bit distorted. So like a clown has big face paint on, they're very surprising, and as a child you find that super scary. So if you're unexpectedly exposed to a clown when you're younger, this is when you kind of develop this phobia of it. But there's quite often people do grow out of this, but some people it sticks with them.
And there's some sort of link between phobias and traumas, isn't there, as well?
Yeah, so if something scary happens to you at a young age, you will often associate that fear, the object or the animal or whatever, with that trauma. When I spoke to Paul Salkowskis, who's a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Bath, and he said that quite often people who have a fear of spiders is if when they're younger, they see like their mum or being scared of spiders, for instance, and seeing your mum being super terrified is actually traumatic for you. So you kind of store that away. And that's quite often where phobias develop from. And this definitely happens a lot with kind of rare phobias. So he treated someone who was afraid of vegetables, but it turned out, yeah, I know, which seems really like, how can someone be afraid of vegetables?
I didn't eat vegetables as I was growing up, but it was tied into a phobia of throwing up. That was it.
Well, there you go then. It often linked to different things. So Paul said that the person he treated that was afraid of vegetables, it turned out that they were partially sighted, and kids at their school would bully them and hit them with vegetables. So that's where the phobia came from. And it's that trauma. You know, it's like something of such a simple object, but if there's a traumatic memory around it, that's where your phobia comes from.
That is horrible.
It's really nasty, isn't it?
Poor child. And so obviously this is clearly a medical condition. So this child, for example, you were talking about them being treated. Vicky, you've got this problem with holes. If we wanted to try and treat you, how would we do this?
So it's actually pretty simple. Both the psychologists I spoke to said single phobia, like fear of spiders, that can be actually solved in about 2 to 3 hours, so a couple of sessions. And you normally get a mixture of exposure therapy, so like it's a very kind of a slow process. You would maybe look at a picture, maybe touch the picture and things like that, and they would just make you go very slowly to kind of get you more comfortable with the object, and then also a mixture of like cognitive behavioral therapy.
Even the idea of doing that's making me feel really sick.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's one of the things, because one of the psychologists I spoke to, John McGovern, he said like people might be like, I don't want to go through that because that's too terrifying for me. But he said, because it is actually so simple to organize, if you did really want to do it, you could get taken to a GP. If you spoke to your GP about it, who would then refer you. No therapist would ever push you further than they know that you're happy going. So because he's like, it is actually quite a simple fear in a way, that they just want to help you solve it like in the best way possible for you. So, but he did say that if you have a different type of phobia, like social phobia or agoraphobia, which is the fear of open spaces, that often takes a bit longer because it's kind of a different type of anxiety to a single phobia.
Why are these different then?
So these kind of phobias are called general phobias, and people who have them are often linked to having other anxiety disorders like panic disorder. So that can't be solved in a single session. He said that, for instance, social phobias, they're not actually linked to a fear of people. It's a fear of doing things in front of other people, and then they'll make fun of you for it, or or you're like embarrassed yourself, and that's like a social phobia.
Like a consequence, like you were saying earlier on, it's not the vegetable they're scared of, it's the fact that they got hit with it when they were a child.
Yeah, exactly. I know, so it still makes me feel really sad when I think about it. So he said, because those kind of phobias are often linked to like wider anxiety disorders, they can't be solved in a single session, but with like the right therapy, he said that could probably be solved in like about 15 to 23 hours, something super specific. So if you do feel that you have a phobia and it is seriously impacting on your life, both the psychologist said to speak to your GP, and you know, you can find the proper source of action of a way to dealing with it there.
And if there are any people who dress up as clowns and go around and scare people, please just stop doing it.
Oh, behave yourselves.
Not very nice.
Well, we've almost passed Halloween, and obviously this type of behaviour does peak around Halloween, unfortunately. So maybe after the 31st of August, we won't see them anymore.
31st of October.
That's what I meant. I don't know why.
Hopefully they'll just grow up after that point. The problem with this killer clown craze, though, and you can't say that quickly, is that some people are taking it to the extreme. So yes, there's some people just wandering around scaring people, but other people are actually committing crimes as these clowns.
Yeah, there was people have been reported being chased down the street. There's been quite a few, like some people said that clowns came up to them, tried to like get in their car and stuff like that.
So this could develop. Their behaviour could give someone a phobia.
Exactly. And you're not really supposed to develop these single phobias after the age of about 9. So it's kind of reversing the scenario. But, there was a guy in Cumbria that said that he was dressing as Batman and he was going to go around and stop the clowns.
Caped crusader against the clowns.
Pretty much.
What is going on in this country? 2016, guys.
It's very scary.
Yeah, so there we have it. I think that's a good place to end for this week. Thank you very much for joining us. Do go and check out all the speakers and fantastic videos from Wired Security. It's a really good event that was really informative and just taught people how to treat themselves online and actually protect themselves as well. And you can also read about phobias and everything that we've discussed on today's podcast on wired.co.uk. We hope to speak to you all again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.